Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. As I'm preparing this show, hearings on the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the U.S. Supreme Court are taking place amid determined protests. If Kavanaugh joins the court, a majority of the justices will be fascist Trump supporters, with all of the horrors that means. We need to resist this. Millions of us, the millions who cannot tolerate the Trump-Pence regime, who refuse to accept a fascist America and all the horrors that go with it, have to get out of our comfort zones, get together, and take to the streets. History is watching, and nothing less will do. You can check out what's going on at refusefascism.org and revcom.us. That's revcom.us. And given the situation today, especially with the continuing rise of fascism, I have decided to run two interviews from earlier shows, precisely because they speak to what's happening today and help us all decide what to do in the face of this. So, at the back end of the show, we'll be hearing an interview I did with Dr. Leroy Carhart. Dr. Carhart has been waging a battle to defend and protect the rights of all women to have access to abortion. He is one of the very few courageous doctors to provide late abortions. He has persevered in the face of legal obstacles and women-hating terror, including the murder of his friend and colleague, Dr. George Tiller. And he's going to talk to us about the many assaults on abortion rights that have already taken place under the Trump-Pence regime.
Before that, we'll be talking with Edward Tabash. And Eddie is a constitutional lawyer in Los Angeles and a board chair of the Center for Inquiry. And he recently wrote about the danger posed by Brett Kavanaugh, Trump's nominee for the Supreme Court, the danger posed to, quite frankly, to the planet and all of humanity. And he's joining us to talk with us about all that today. Eddie, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate this.
Sure.
The opportunity to sound the alarm about the president's nominee to the court. I'm going to be confining, if I may, my comments to my area of expertise, separation of church and state. And here again, particularly for a progressive audience, we have to begin with the massive inherent contradiction in religious right-wing ideology. The former governor of New York, Mario Cuomo, said it very well when he said, "It's rank hypocrisy of the religious right to preach to us, the American people, about limited government, and then to turn around and tell us what God to believe in and how to apply the judgment of that God to our bodies and to our bedrooms." Another great contradiction is religious right-wing jurists like Scalia, who called on government to openly favor believers over non-believers, wants majority rule, and he believes that even members of the LGBTQ community can be criminally prosecuted for private consensual adult acts. And he said that all you need is a majority of the state acting through the legislature. Well, I don't think Scalia ever realized during his lifetime that he was invoking his own somewhat crazy version of power to the people. He was basically saying, ignoring constitutional democracy and saying the majority can do anything. The problem with Kavanaugh is he believes in the special privileging of religion, as we can see from his decisions. A very dangerous decision, he wrote, was in Priests for Life. The Affordable Care Act gave religious institutions a very generous opt-out from providing contraception for their employees, which itself is problematic. And we lost that issue in the Hobby Lobby case in a split 5-4 decision. But with this organization of anti-choice, anti-contraception priests wanted to do was they didn't even want to have to give the government a small notice that they were not providing contraception. What the Affordable Care Act said is, if you're not going to provide contraception for religious reasons, just let us know so that the insurance carrier will be able to provide it to the employee directly under another plan. And these religious spoiled brats said, no, even that would put us in the line of fire of being involved in a process that would ultimately obtain contraception for our employees. And Kavanaugh wrote for a majority, it was a 2-to-1 decision in that case, that all religious people have to do to opt out of complying with laws that bind the rest of us is just sincerely state a religious belief, and that's it.
Eddie, let me ask you this. Let me ask you this, because we're going to get into a lot of what you're talking about, but there's some things that I really want, I think people need to think about as we go into this, okay? I mean, for one thing, the proper understanding of the importance of something like the separation of church and state, why it's important that the state can't force any individual to believe or not believe in any religion. And this is something that, you know, when you look at like the zeal with which they are trying to push through this thing of getting Kavanaugh into the Supreme Court and then everything that he brings with him, let's just sort of walk through this a little bit, okay? The proper understanding of the importance of separation of church and state, why is that so damn important?
The reason why it's so important is because it preserves the rights of conscience for everyone, believers and non-believers. Now, what's interesting is the religious right takes the view that government cannot favor one religion over others, but can favor all religions against non-belief, that government can actually disfavor atheism and non-belief. And according to Scalia, government can even disfavor non-monotheistic religions. But if you look at the history of the framing of the First Amendment, it's absolutely remarkable. In September of 1789, when the religion clauses were in the Senate before they were finalized, there were two wordings which would have done just that, just saying government can't prefer one sect to another, and they were both discarded and never brought back. So the Congress considered only just prohibiting government from favoring one religion over another, and the final wording is no law even respecting an establishment of religion. And Madison, the principal author of the religion clauses of the First Amendment, had written to Jefferson many times prior to actually crafting the First Amendment, worrying about the equal rights of infidels and the rights of conscience of everybody. So if you're a judicial conservative and you want to go on original intent, it's on our side. Another reason, too, why the separation of church and state is important is the ideological and intellectual freedom of a human being. If the conservatives are going to talk to us about limited government, then certainly you don't have limited government if the government can play favorites based on your metaphysical view of the world. Whether to believe or not believe in the supernatural and how you believe the universe was put together is a very intimate, private act of conscience. And for the government to be able to say, you are a preferred member of society because you believe in this supernatural being rather than that one or no one, would be the worst form of intellectual and ideological tyranny.
Let me ask you this. The state, you know, basically what you're getting at is the state really cannot force any individual to believe or not believe in religion. That's under the proper understanding of the importance of the separation of church and state, why it's important. But there's something that's going on now that's extremely important, I think. When this has been the view, as you wrote in your recent article, this has been the view since the late 1940s, and this is what Trump and his Christian fascist supporters are out to change. So what is their view? What's Trump's view? So people can get a handle on this. What actually is the view of Trump and the Christian fascists around this?
Okay, first of all, to know what Trump's personal opinion is would require psychic ability that I, as a skeptic, don't believe exists. What I think is happening is he's realizing that without the evangelical base, he wouldn't have been elected, nor would he be reelected in 2 years. So what he's doing is he's giving religious right-wing ideologue jurists the opportunity to take over the federal judiciary, specifically the Supreme Court. and their purpose is to let majority rule in terms of government favoritism for religion. So again, taking the Scalia view, Scalia, for instance, when Kennedy wrote the majority opinion saying no branch of government can any longer criminally punish persons of the same gender who are adults and consensually have intimacy, Scalia said, no, that's not true. The people acting collectively can express moral disapproval of this kind of conduct by continuing criminal penalties. So what they are really after is a theocratic society. And Trump probably doesn't understand the subtleties of constitutional law. And if you were to ask Trump, do you believe that government should be able to favor religion over non-belief, he'd say, absolutely. And then I would say, what about non-preferentialism, that government cannot favor one religion over others? And if I use the word non-preferentialism, which is used by religious right-wingers to discuss the collective favoring of religion, he probably wouldn't have a clue. So it's not Trump, it's what he and perhaps the most sincerely extreme religious right-winger ever to attain high office in our country, which would be Vice President Pence, are allowing the judiciary to do. So the issue is, what do his judges believe? And we got this insight on Kavanaugh's views, where he said all the religious have to do to opt out of laws that bind everyone else is say, my religion prohibits my complying with this law, even if it means I'm going to discriminate, and I sincerely hold the view.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Edward Tabash, a constitutional lawyer in Los Angeles and the chair of the board of directors of the Center for Inquiry. He recently wrote about the extreme danger for humanity of putting Brett Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court.
Let me ask you this, because, you know, we're talking about all this, and I want to try and give people who might not be familiar with a lot of the terms and things that's being thrown around, but let's talk about this in the sense of, you know, you're talking about Kavanaugh now. Okay. So you're looking at what goes on there, and sort of what he's reacting, or what the sort of the boat that he rode in on is one that was piloted and developed by Scalia, and his argument that that basically the Establishment Clause, for instance, is something that allows the disregard of devout atheists in any consideration of anything. And even further, it impacts a broad swath of unconventional religious beliefs. So there's actually anybody who basically doesn't believe in the enforced Christian mythology or whatever, the forced Christian religion, that's part and parcel of what Trump is doing. Because whether Trump is a religious guy or not, he certainly sees a place that he needs to ally with these people in terms of putting into making reality out of his current program and what he's trying to do. So let's talk about this. What about this point about how the late Justice Scalia and his argument that this clause that we've been talking about, this clause that this allows the disregard of devout atheists and even a broad swath of unconventional religious beliefs. There's a danger here, and I'd like people to, one, know what this is, what's going on here, and then what's the danger?
Hey, well, the danger would be government would easily be able to say non-believers are outcasts, and then that's bad enough, and then the Scalia view would also be able to show that same disdain for minority religions. But there's even something worse than Scalia currently on the court. Justice Clarence Thomas takes the view that the Establishment Clause doesn't protect rights of conscience of anyone, that the only purpose of the Establishment Clause, and this is really a twisted interpretation, is so the federal government can't stop the states from having official religions. So Clarence Thomas's very bizarre view of the Establishment Clause is its sole purpose would be to allow each state to have an official religion that could not be interfered with by the federal government. But the idea, to quote Sandra Day O'Connor, a moderate conservative who was an extremely powerful supporter of church-state separation. No branch of government should be able to treat anyone differently based on their accepting or rejecting of any tenet of religious belief. Now, what I think this also goes to, and the problem we have, it's an attitude educational problem here in the United States where people fear that somehow you can't really have morality without grounding it in a supernatural being. And so with that fear, even though there's been a rise of non-believers, with that fear, there's this idea that atheists or those who don't believe in a punishing God will have no moral basis. It's like in the Brother Karamazov, the 19th century novel, if God doesn't exist, all things are permitted. But what they miss is that if you ground your belief in the supernatural deity in the Bible, you see this deity committing the worst atrocities, genocides and killing of innocent children and ordering whole tribes wiped out, and this vengeful vindictiveness. So that's a real problem. The only thing is that the Constitution will always mean, even though those of us who understand it can see clearly what parts of it mean, for practical purposes it means what five justices at any given moment in our history say it means. Mm-hmm. So since 1947, we've always had at least five justices to say non-believers are equal before the law. Now we're going to have five justices who say they're not. So that's a sea change in terms of taking away freedoms. If possible, I would like to address some of the pragmatics of this. We have an uphill battle in stopping this nomination. However, if anybody knows anyone who resides in Alaska or Maine, it's important that they contact Maine's Republican senator, who sometimes wavers on right-wing nominees, Susan Collins, and Alaska's Republican senator, who also sometimes departs from the right wing, Lisa Murkowski. If we could get hold every Democrat and get two defecting Republicans, we could defeat the nomination. It's quite iffy, but it's worth trying.
Okay, now listen, in one thing, as you're saying that, I'm thinking, okay, but right now what we face, and really, I mean, look at the lack of backbone and any incentive to actually go up against this on the part of all of these people that are currently running the government and the system. And I think that there's an importance for people to actually understand what is it that, because I think the most important thing for people to do is to get out there and basically take up the fight against what's happening with the rise of this guy, of Kavanaugh, to the slated rise of Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. And what's it going to mean? Because here's the question for you, and it's going to have real meaning for people all over the country. It's going to have people deep, real meaning for many, many people. And let's look at this, because Kavanaugh, he talks about, he's not a big fan of separation in church and state. Well, that's a pretty much foundational question there. And he agrees with an argument that was advanced by Rehnquist that the separation of church and state was based on what? Bad history. And then he argues that any form of neutrality between belief and non-belief is actually hostility to religion. And therefore, religion needs to be actually protected. So let's talk about these things.
Yeah. Okay. Well, to say it's the special privileging of religion, what is untenable from any standpoint of logic and fairness, is the view that if you don't give religion special favoritism, you're against religion. And what makes this more horrific is he said that if you didn't have prayers at the inauguration ceremony, you would be establishing atheism. Well, that's like saying that if you didn't talk about a godless universe at inaugurations, you would be establishing religion. The fact that you are silent doesn't mean you're hostile to anyone. It means the opposite, that you're neutral and embracing of all points of view. So this shows a very illogical and very extreme preferentialism for religion. The other thing, too, which is very interesting, when Trump was accepting the Republican nomination for president, he talked about his support for same-sex marriage. But then he goes around putting people on the Supreme Court who are almost virtually reliable votes to undo all the LGBTQ rights cases of the past 20 years, of which Kennedy, incidentally, wrote all the majority opinions. Now, to show you how cynical Trump is about this, there was a meeting in the White House, I think last October, between the president, the vice president, and some evangelicals, and the gay rights issue came up. So Trump laughingly pointed to Pence and said, "Don't ask that guy over there. He wants to hang them all." Well, how does somebody who says he supports the right of same-sex marriage joke about the fact that he chose, for one heartbeat away from the presidency, somebody who wants to hang them all? See, to the president, this is he's playing with people's lives, their freedoms, and their core ability to define themselves as equal members of society without worrying about religious dogma. He's treating it as a political game, as a game. So this is very, very frightening. Also, we have to understand that Pence, Trump's vice president, Pence actually was an early supporter of conversion therapy, which was the idea that religious-based psychotherapy could cure people who love those of the same gender and make them heterosexual. So we have a very, very grave problem here of religion being used as a basis to dehumanize good human beings who aren't harming anyone. And this is all wrapped up in the danger that government would no longer be neutral in matters of religion.
Tell me this: how dangerous is it? I mean, we're getting up close to the end of our conversation, but how dangerous is this in terms of both what's going on now, what's coming up now, but also in terms of the future? Because I'm really concerned about this. That you know, one, people have to understand this, but they have to understand it with the understanding too that actually, you know, as they used to say in the old movies, people need to be in the streets with pitchforks and, you know, whatever, to going down the street chanting or stopping this stuff. This is not pitchforks and torches in the streets. That's it. And, you know, this is the kind of response that's really demanded around this. And I think it's really important what you're saying about this thing of, like, Trump and what he puts out and what he goes for, and then what he really backs and what he sets loose in this alliance he has with the Christian fascists. And that's really extremely important for people to understand, and to understand how dangerous is this in the future. I mean, in your article, you talk about a lot of things, the practical things that will happen to people, but it even goes beyond the points that you've mentioned there, you know, where it's actually all of the various repercussions of having these Christian religious fascists out there and given free run over the entire, if Trump had it his way, over the entire planet. Let's talk about that.
Here's the first one. The first freedom to be lost that we're going to feel in a most horrible way will be the overturning of Roe versus Wade by a new majority of Roberts, Alito, Thomas, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh, where now the states, for the first time since 1973, will be permitted to ban abortion if they choose to do so. And at least a bare majority of states will do so instantaneously. The very fact that a woman's right to control a process unfolding entirely within her body will now be subject to criminalization by the state that she lives in is going to have horrendous repercussions. And so what this will mean is we will have to be able to supply to women in those states the means by which to go to other states so they can have the abortion procedure. But the removal of blanket nationwide constitutional protection for the right to choose is going to be the first shockwave that we're going to feel if Kavanaugh is confirmed to the court. Mm-hmm. And that's very practical, and that's very real. Also, another aspect of this, which is really inseparable, is not only will employers be able to refuse to provide insurance coverage for contraception, if you say the states can ban abortion, then the states will be able to define life as beginning at the moment of fertilization and be able to ban post-fertilization means of contraception like IUDs and a number of birth control pills. So it's in the area of reproductive freedoms that, to use your very appropriate phraseology, we're going to feel it in the streets. Mm-hmm. That'll be the first blow.
Mm-hmm. All right. This has been a really eye-opening conversation, Edward. So, Eddie, how about we talk again sometime in the near future?
Thank you.
Okay, take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Edward Tabash, a constitutional lawyer in Los Angeles and the board chair of the Center for Inquiry, and he recently wrote about the danger posed by Brett Kavanaugh, Trump's nominee for the Supreme Court. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back. All right, welcome back. And I know you know that song. It's the Isley Brothers with Fight the Power, all right? It's a great song, and I thought it was really what I was feeling this morning. All right, now we're going to hear an interview with Dr. Leroy Carhart. And Dr. Carhart is waging a battle to defend and protect the right of all women to have access to abortion. He's one of the very few courageous doctors to provide late abortions. And recently, his clinic in Maryland was abruptly closed by the landlord, who announced that it had been bought up by anti-woman fascists. So without any further ado, let's just jump right into that. And I'm very pleased to welcome to the show Dr. Lee Carhart. And Dr. Carhart has been providing abortion care for over 45 years. And to further assist women, in 2000, Dr. Carhart and his wife, Mary Carhart, established a nonprofit organization, the Abortion Access Fund, Inc., which helps patients pay for abortion care through generous donations from across the U.S. It assists clinic owners in keeping their doors open and supports the opening of new clinics. Dr. Carhart's mission is to train future providers in advanced gestation abortion care to ensure abortion not only stays legal, but accessible in the decades to come. And this is a major, major challenge right now before all of us, basically to maintain what is a basic human right for women and is constantly being attacked. And by the way, you get an idea of what Dr. Carhart is all about if you check out the documentary, the 2013 documentary, After Tiller. Lee, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you, Michael, and thank you for having me on.
Yeah, definitely. I keep thinking about you every time I read the newspaper about something about abortion. I think, gotta call Lee. So I'm really glad we were able to hook up this time. Let's jump into it. You recently wrote an op-ed piece for Truthout, and you were pointing to a new escalation in the attacks on a woman's right to abortion. And you say that anti-abortion politicians are more brazen than ever under the Trump regime. What's happening? Give people a sense of what's happening.
You know, I mean, with the changes in the Department of Justice, with, you know, Sessions and the whole Republican, they're not enforcing some of the laws that used to be there, or in fact, the laws are still there. They're just taking less of an importance in enforcing them. But the main problem is right now, like this recent episode in Texas that I was talking about in that op-ed piece, is, you know, to deny a woman that's incarcerated a minor and is pregnant and didn't want to be and still doesn't want to be, yet they're going to keep her incarcerated. And she's also in the legal alien, and that's why she's incarcerated, not that she did anything else wrong. So they're going to make her have a child that, you know, they talk about they don't want anchor babies. Now they're forcing her to have one when she didn't want that to happen. I mean, it's just a continuation of the goal of old white rich men trying to control women. And, you know, no matter how you cut the abortion issue, that is the abortion issue.
That's pretty heavy, actually. You know, talk about this, too. Going beyond, you know, this individual case that you were talking about, you've written about as well that there's been an explosion of state-level restrictions since 2010. And this is fairly heavy because a lot of people have thought, okay, well, on one level, while, yes, there's a fight to maintain and push forward the right of a woman to have an abortion when she wants one, and people may have thought that maybe things are easing up a little bit, but there's actually been a whole storm of an explosion of state-level restrictions over the last 10 years, 7 years. Let's talk about that.
Yeah. This year alone, Michael, in the current legislatures in the United States, there are 424 anti-choice legislative pieces that have been introduced. In the federal government, there have been 25. And this is not new this year. The number is new this year. Last year it was like in the 300s, I believe. So, you know, only a few of them get through. But first of all, if you count the countless hours that the politicians spend debating these issues, you know, it makes it understandable why nothing that's really important in this country gets done, because the people that can control the Congresses or the Houses and the Senates of the states, or the unicameral in my state, they prevent the important legislation from ever getting to the floor by tying up days in committee work. It's just a total waste of time, not even to look into the fact that everything that they're proposing is really an assault on women's health care. I mean, abortion is health care, and health care is a human right, and abortion is a human right. It's just, you have to draw that line. The anti say, oh, well, we just want to eliminate the late-term abortion because, you know, nobody likes late-term abortion. But if you ask any of the leaders of the anti-choice what they consider late-term, and that's the day after conception. So that's what they're trying to eliminate.
Now, one of the things that happens, too, though, is that there are people like yourself who actually say, to hell with that, and you're going to stand up against that. And you have never stopped actually providing abortions for women when you've been able to do that, when women have needed and when you've been able to do that. And now they have a new thing that's coming up where they're talking about, what is it called, a 20-week ban. And under that, I understand that not only is that, you know, the attack on women, but it's also for people like yourself. That could mean if you continue to stay true to your principles and provide abortions for women, that could actually mean a jail sentence for you.
Oh, absolutely, it could. You know, that's been their goal. In Nebraska, we had a clinic, and, you know, hindsight is 2020, and maybe we didn't handle it right. Maybe we should have challenged the 20-week ban in Nebraska. But now it's in, I think, 26 states or something like that. And, of course, the federal government's toying with the issue. And if it passes, it'll get tied up in the courts for 2 or 3 years, hopefully long enough to get somebody in Washington that has a little bit of empathy for women's issues, and we can avert the disaster. But I think, you know, it all comes down to one thing, and until women will get out and demand what's their choice, it's not going to happen. Doctors can't cause it to happen. Politicians can't cause it to happen unless the women of this country put them there, and they've been putting them there, and it's time that the women wake up and say, enough is enough. We need to have people that believe in choice, and then we'll worry about what their other issues are.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dr. Lee Carhart. Lee has been providing abortion care for over 45 years and has been right in the middle of the assault on abortion and the fight to defend abortion rights and the humanity of women everywhere. Yeah, you know, one thing I think, too, though, and I would agree with that, except I also would say, hey, there's got to be a lot more people like you, not just abortion providers, but also people who, men, who will stand up and say, this is a woman's basic, fundamental human right to have an abortion, and it should not be toyed with. It should not be, you know, turned into a crime. And one of the things I kept thinking about as I was reading about, you know, reading some of the things that you've written, some of the stuff that's been happening, that there is actually a kind of steamroller. And there's a lot of steamrolling moves that oftentimes when you see what's happening, when they're just plowing through all the stuff that's been, you know, advances that have been made in terms of abortion rights for women. You know, you see this, it often means much more than the normal harassment of women trying to get an abortion, which is, you know, you can see it in any city where there's abortion clinics. You can see the, you know, these Christian fascists come out and they try to stand in front of clinics or harass people, do all these things, or even the people who've threatened to do bodily harm and kill people for going in and trying to have an abortion or kill abortion doctors. Now, you've talked about this. In fact, there's been a recent situation with you. I remember when I last spoke to you, we were talking about your clinic that you had established in Germantown, Maryland. And then I read something where actually your clinic no longer exists. That particular clinic no longer exists in Germantown. It was recently forced to close as a result of the kind of stepped up assaults we're talking about. Tell people what's happened and what the impact of that is.
The issue in Germantown came from a small, I think a relatively small, one parish church and a organization called Kick Carhartt out of Maryland. They were able to raise in 6 months over $1.6 million to buy the clinic from the present landlords and pay them a significant bonus in what the value of the clinic was. They had to sign that they would never participate in abortion clinic practice again, or what that was all part of this deal. But they sold it to the Maryland Coalition for Life, who on the date of the purchase order being signed or the contract evicted us. That was also part of the negotiations. And so we had zero notice. In fact, I had worked Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday that week, flew home to Nebraska. When I landed in Nebraska in the morning on Thursday, there was an email to call, and I called the clinic manager, and she said, "We've been evicted, I'm locked out, and we can't get the records." We ended up even having to go into court to get the medical records out of the hands of the anti-choice people. I mean, the old owners had them, but they wouldn't release them to us because they didn't feel that that was what they were going to do. And our biggest worry was that they were going to be compromised and the patients compromised. We now have the records. We were able to win that court suit. But this is a small parish. This is one church and one small organization. We're able to raise $1.6 million in 6 months to close one clinic. Sorry, the owners had two clinics that they owned, but they bought one, and the other one they just had to step away from. It's crazy, you know. It's everything comes down, and this issue is like every other issue in life. It's time and money, and that's what we don't have. I mean, well, the women don't have time because their issues are critical. They have maybe 2 to 3 months from the time they find out they're pregnant until they can't have anything else done. So I don't know the issue. I just know what I think we need to do, and that's to train more doctors. I'd love to see first trimester abortions go back to OBGYN offices and be done by their primary care doctors. And I think there's need for specialty abortion clinics after that, because unless you do a lot of something in medicine, you probably shouldn't do any of it. So to keep abortion safe and legal, we're going to need clinics to take care of the women after the first trimester. That's where we are, and that's what I'm trying to do, is to train the docs to take care, or to even give them a chance to realize what the patients need. In medical schools in this country, the doctors are not exposed to patients that are in need of termination, so they never have any idea what the patients are going through. And that's one of the reasons that we've been working closely with some of the medical programs to have their docs just come in, sit and talk with the patients, understand why they're here, and understand that this is not a black and white issue. This is really, well, I guess it kind of is a black and white issue. It's the mother's decision of what this child is going to bring into her life, either a lifetime of joy or a lifetime of disaster. And she's the only one that knows the answer to that issue.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me this, Lee, because one of the things I kept thinking about is there really is a special importance to, one, as you're saying, to independent abortion clinics and providers. And also this point of, you know, the kind of steamrolling move that was made against your clinic, that actually was very much tied up in your refusal to sort of accept a lot of the limitations, not just the outright banning of abortion or abortion rights, or the fact that over the last number of years there's been so many anti-abortion bills, it's just mind-boggling. But you've actually said that there was kind of a special significance to this forced shutdown in that it was one of the few clinics in the country that provided abortion no matter what, no matter if it was a very beginning of a pregnancy or if it was a late term. If a woman needed it, you would give it to her. Let's talk about that a little, the importance of that.
Right now, there are three clinics that are noted. Well, we're willing to admit that we're doing the later abortions, and there are three docs that are in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and there's one doctor in Boulder, and there's myself on the East Coast. Just the fact that you're willing to tell people that you're out there for them, it takes a serious amount of you know, deciding to give up your own personal safety and your own personal life. I mean, we know that we're going to be harassed if we tell the people that this is what we're doing. But the women also need to know that our services are available, because we had a patient just a couple weeks, right after we first opened here, 28 or 29 weeks pregnant with a baby that could not survive, that had been told at 24 weeks that there was nothing she could do. And it wasn't until the word about the closing of this clinic and the unavailability that hit the media that she went to her doctors and said, "You can't tell me that there's nothing I can do. I need to find." And then she eventually found us on the internet, and at 29 weeks was able to take care of a problem that should have been taken care of at 24 or 25 weeks. You know, and so, you know, we can't blame women for choosing late abortions or late. I hate that definition because, as I said before, late term is the day after conception in some people's mind. But later gestation, advanced gestation abortions, they happen because of a myriad of problems. But I don't think one ever happened because, well, I've been pregnant for 28 weeks, but I think I don't want it anymore. That's not there.
That's a very important point, man, actually. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dr. Lee Carhart. Lee has been providing abortion care for over 45 years and has been right in the middle of the assault on abortion and the fight to defend abortion rights and the humanity of women everywhere. One of the things, too, I wanted to ask you, and again, this gets into the importance of this, of independent abortion clinics and providers. And that's something that you've always fought for, but also it's been both a matter of necessity, not just a question of will or feeling, you know, or sentiment, but it's extremely important that women are able to find clinics like what you're operating, what you're running, because it is, you know, it does come down to, and you can see it in the attacks that are coming, and it does come down to basically, not just an assault on the rights of women, but an assault on, as you mentioned, the actual humanity of women and their ability to control their own bodies, do what they need to do, what they feel they have to do, you know, or they want to do. That's a big question here. And so I'd like to talk about that a little bit.
That brings up to my mind the thought about the crisis pregnancy centers, that issue. A very prominent person in the media I was with just recently, and her story was, at the age of 16, well, she lived in a rural area in the Midwest, one of these pregnancy centers for all information, and was given, when she got there, she was told that, well, congratulations, you're pregnant, here's all the information about having a baby. And she said, well, what if I don't want to have a baby? And she says, oh, well, you know, it's not legal in our realm, is the way she said it. It was not legal in the church or the sponsorship of the group, but she just said in our instead of in the United, you know, but in our state, it's not legal. And so she thought she was breaking the law. And then after being, she called it, badgered for about 35 or 40 minutes with all these anti-choice things, and she said, well, I'm going to have to go talk to somebody else about abortion. And she said, well, you know, abortion is murder. And so she looked at her again and thought about that. And then when she walked out the door, the lady said, well, if you choose to murder your child, you're going to be damned. And then these crisis pregnancy centers receive money from the government. In Nebraska, they get money from the tobacco fund. That all goes to the crisis pregnancy centers. They're all tax exempt. They don't participate in support of our society, yet they just present only one view and intentionally mislead and confuse women. And this is a college educated now. I mean, she was only 16 at the time, but she was not one of the less informed women in the world, you know. The government can't keep, well, it can, obviously. It's been doing it for 30 years now since Roe, but the government should not be enforcing one side of the issue. If they wanted to present both sides, I think that would be phenomenal. But just to say, to support and pay people to stand out and say abortion's not legal in the United States, or they didn't quite say that, but to infer that, and to call people murderers that are seeking really an important part of health care. And this woman's gone on to be a very, very prominent member of society. And as she just told me, that if I hadn't done this, I'd probably be another role in statistics in the welfare mm-hmm. plan to having a child at 16 and an abusive boyfriend.
You know, it's incredible because you think about this, too. It's just, when people are talking about this, it's not as though, you know, you made a point about sort of what this all is part of. And I kept thinking about, you know, when you watched, you know, The Handmaid's Tale, you know, on yes. television this last year. And you think about what that reduces women to, where they're reduced to people who serve, or they're reduced to, you know, not even sentient beings. They're allowed to walk around dressed like, you know, in an iron cloak and, you know, serve sexually the master of the house. And it has everything that's tied up with this has to do with, you know, then the adulation of a woman who you're only worth something if you produce a baby for the regime and all this stuff. And you think about everything that's happening in relation to abortion has so much to do with the actual robbery of the humanity of women. I mean, it really is important. You mentioned that earlier, but I keep thinking, keep coming back to that. And I think that's one thing that's always stuck out in relation to your work, is that insisting on the humanity of the women who live in the world.
One of the things that got me into abortion in the first place to believe in abortion as a young person was the inherent inequality of parenting. You know, like the male partner in a relationship has the right to divorce. I mean, the right to abort the child from the moment after conception until the kid is 16, 18 years old. All they do is walk out of the picture. Nothing's held against them. If they can track them down, and if they have income, and if you can prevent them from changing jobs every week so that the courts can force them to pay the income, pay the support. But men have had this right of abortion and able to effect, just walk away from the pregnancy at any time. And I think to deny that from the mother is just inequality to start with. The mother has no more obligation, in my heart and mind, to the child than the father does. Well, I guess what I should say, the father has no less of an obligation to the rights and welfare of the child than the mother does. So until we can provide support, you know, I think it should be illegal to produce a child without the consent of the partner. I don't think that rape is, I mean, it's not the rape part, but they shouldn't be able to conceive either. I mean, to make it legal, to make it right, to make it fair. If a man causes a pregnancy, either intentionally or unintentionally, then I think he should have the same responsibility throughout the life of that child that the mother has.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about
until you can provide that, then I think there's no rational argument against abortion.
Mm-hmm. Now, what do you think about the argument that's been made recently that says the abortion rate in this country has fallen to its lowest point since the Roe v. Wade decision in 1973, and since that legalized abortion? How do you read this? What do you think about this in terms of this point?
I think I read it as the abortion providers in this country are doing a good job. We're trying to educate women on birth control. We're trying to help them to prevent pregnancies. The morning after pill, the birth control developments that have came, all these things have came, and I think abortion doctors by far talk about future pregnancies and prevention of them to their patients than pretty much any of the even family practice docs. I mean, I'm sorry, even the family planning docs that are out there. I mean, we tell every patient, and this came from my training, is that my job is here, yes, to help you with this pregnancy, but B, to help you have a better life and not need to come back. And even if you get pregnant again, that's not a problem. But it not on your emotions, on your thoughts, on your mental health, and on your financial health, abortion is a big deal. So if we can prevent it, that's our primary mission, after we take care of the immediate problem. So I think we're doing a good job. I know the antis have made abortion less available so that women have to travel farther and probably many babies are being born because of that very issue, just that the woman can't get an abortion. But I don't see a problem with the decline in abortion rates. I think that's a phenomenal statement that we're doing our job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very good point. Now let's talk about this one last thing that people need to know. You're not shut down in Maryland. You actually did, in fact, rise up and start a whole new clinic. Tell people about that.
Okay. Well, we were able to find a building. Actually, it has about a third more space than the last clinic did. It was close enough that we could keep the same staff, so we lost nobody as far as the trained staff, and which is, you know, in any business, a good staff is the key to your success. It's not what you bring to it, but it's what you select and help find other people to train them to do to make it really a good issue. We have better hours. We're going to be able to provide service longer. I've had requests for people from doctors to come and be trained to start doing abortions, with us, and then look to the point of maybe branching out, opening another practice somewhere else in the country. So it's been a good thing. You know, I hated for it to happen, but looking at the big picture, I think not only I, but the women in the United States have made an improvement in our lifestyle. I mean, we're able to take care of them. So I think it turned out to be a good thing.
Okay, great.
It was expensive, but as I said, money is the issue. So we were able to get it and move forward.
Mm-hmm. All right, great news, Lee. I want to ask you one other question, then we'll see if we can fit this in. As we're talking about all this, I keep thinking about, yes, it's really important that we've come to this point where we're actually, you know, able to say that you've been able to reestablish your clinic, that there's a fight going on that's not one-sided, that there is actually people coming forward to stand with women and with humanity, because that's what it is. It's the right of women to an abortion is a right, a human right. And one of the things that I found as I was reading and preparing for this, one of the things that I found is that in Ohio, they actually recently have tried to or did enact a heartbeat bill.
Yeah, Ohio and North Dakota has been playing with something very close to this also. In fact, I think theirs is in existence, but it's being challenged. Yeah, the Center for Reproductive Rights, it's a national legal organization that defends women's, they don't defend the women, but they defend the legal options that are given to women in the courts. And, you know, this is essentially, as I said in the beginning, that late term is after conception. I mean, they just keep whittling away. Ohio has the 20-week ban. You know, well, Indiana with Mike Pence passed this bill where if the baby has any deformity known, diagnosed, then if it's only 2 weeks after conception, you can't terminate that pregnancy. What it's doing exactly, you know, the women from Ohio, I have three patients this Sunday that are coming from in Ohio and one from Indiana. So, you know, it makes the travel farther. But, of course, their goals are to get this passed in the Midwest where it's easier to do these things to women. And then as they gain steam, they'll keep, like they are with the 20-week ban now, trying to get to the federal government level where it becomes a national law that if there's a heartbeat, you can't terminate a pregnancy. You know, is it constitutional? It's not even close to constitutional, but that doesn't mean the Supreme Court can't uphold it. I mean, it's just damaging. And again, it comes back to the very basic thing that until the women of this country are willing to stand up and fight for their rights, maybe they're too old to need abortions anymore, but their nieces and their nephews and their daughters and their offspring of the future aren't. And I think, you know, my brother was openly gay, and we've talked about this forever, and the reason for the gay rights movement to be where it is today is not because of where we started differently, because in 1972, we were both in the same place. Both women were badly beaten up, and the gay portion of the public were beaten up. But the difference is women are pregnant for 9 months, and they need an abortion in a window of about 8 or 10 weeks, where it means everything. It's the end of the world. But after that, it goes away. But when you're gay for life, and you know what you need to fight for. But what we need to do now is convince the women not to only fight for it when they're pregnant and need an abortion, but they have to go on and, and, establish themselves and demand their equality until everything gets to be normal for them.
Mm-hmm. All right, Lee. And I would add just one more thing. A whole lot of men got to get into that, too. Got to stand with women and take this up. Lee Carhart, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. Take care, man. That was Dr. Leroy Carhart, a heroic abortion provider and one of the very few courageous doctors to provide late-term abortions. He has persevered in the face of legal obstacles and anti-women terror, including the murder of his friend and colleague, Dr. George Tiller. Dr. Carhart is waging a battle to defend and protect the right of all women to have access to abortion and the right for them to be full human beings, recognized as full human beings. And as I said at the beginning of the show, if you want to find out and join the resistance, go to refusefascism.org and revcom.us. Once again, that's R-E-V as in Victor, C-O-M.us. And when you go there, you're going to find an important announcement of a new film of a speech by Bob Avakian, B.A., Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. We'll have more to say about that in the coming weeks as well. And that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my engineer, Gary Baca. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com.
We're going to go out now real quick with Sound the Alarm from Thievery Corporation. Talk to you next weekend. Sound that alarm! We need it!